Now on view at SCAD Fesh, Manish Arora's life is beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at scadfash.org.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
In Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. Christian Cave is a Kennesaw State University environmental studies major who's on a mission to help us love and care about Georgia wildlife rather than fear it. Cave is now a City Lights contributor for our series Expedition Atlanta. And today, he slithers up to the mic to discuss the many varieties of snakes that live in and around our city. Also later this hour, Atlanta-based paper artist Alex Wolf in our series Speaking of Art. First, Dope Coffee in Decatur has combined delectable blends of coffee with a touch of hip-hop culture to create a distinctive style and vibe. Not only does it offer rich coffee, Dope also serves as a coffee manufacturing center, complete with a tasting room, an event space, a lounge, a studio, even a basketball court. Co-founders and co-owners Michelle and Michael Lloyd join me now via Zoom to talk more about the enterprise. Welcome to City Lights.
Thank you so much for that great intro. Honestly, Dope Coffee here in Atlanta is exactly what you said. I don't think I could have described it better than that. We are delighted to be here and to offer all of the pleasant aromas from East Africa to Central America and to manufacture it right here in Atlanta. So really delighted to be here.
Oh, fantastic. I don't know if you ever saw any of the Looney Tunes cartoons. I realize I'm dating myself because I was a little kid when Bugs Bunny and all those things came out. But there used to be, I guess you'd call it like a cliche. If someone was really enticed, or one of the characters was enticed by an aroma of something cooking, you'd see the cartoon character sort of floating off the ground to the scent, you know, the wonderful aroma. Did you ever see one of those?
Yes, actually, I feel like I remember a clip of Daffy Duck like that, kind of smelling the aroma and just kind of floating and just being very like in the sensual moment.
Oh, okay, Mike. Well, as Michelle was speaking about your blends from Ethiopia and Central America, I was floating and experiencing those aromas. So you are also a hip-hop artist. What was your introduction to hip-hop culture?
So started quite a while back. Really, starting in music began in the church. I used to run audio for the church, and I also was a song leader in the congregation. So I was writing hymns and just all types of music, and then got involved with a band in middle school and played the trumpet for a bit. And it really took off once I got to college. I had already been heavily influenced by hip hop. My older sister is about 10 years older than me. So in the 80s, I was born in 1984. And so she had already been really immersed in hip hop culture. So I grew up just listening to a lot of the music that she listened to. And by my freshman year in college, I was already making my own CDs, writing more songs across multiple genres, and then let go of it for a while after I finished undergrad. I had to get a little bit more focused in life, but was fortunate to be able to move back to Atlanta and really reconnect with my hip hop roots and really bring it to the forefront.
How cool. Michelle, I read you are a chef. You trained as a chef and you're a certified nutritionist. Do you have music in your resume as well?
I do have music in my resume. When Mike was putting together his music albums in college, I was kind of right there with him. And honestly, even when he got back into like producing music and everything like that, I kind of jumped back in it too. So, I mean, I love hip hop. I love music in general, grew up listening to it. And kind of just like you were saying, you were like immersed in like the smells of the different aromas. That's kind of what hip hop does to me when I listen to it. So it kind of propelled me through cooking. Like I play it when I cook. It inspires me to be creative. So it's definitely a part of my life.
Oh, that is so cool. Now, I read that you both lived in Wilmington, North Carolina before moving to Atlanta. What made you decide to create a coffee business?
So Mike was in the Marine Corps at that point, so we were stationed at Camp Lejeune, and we were living down in Sneed's Ferry. And at that point, we knew that we needed to add to what we were going to do, like once he got out of the Marine Corps, once I was established as a dietitian, and we really wanted to step into entrepreneurship, start something for our family so that we can have it in the future. And as we were kind of scouting everything, I remember Mike sitting on the couch and he was looking around. He did some research and he said, hey, like we're really kind of in a coffee desert here. And I really think this could be our take at it, because he was kind of putting together his skills as being an engineer and my skills as, you know, being a culinary chef and a dietitian. Once we kind of put those together, he got together this kiosk and he said, hey, we can make it happen from here. And we did. The kiosk we built was, we had two of them, two drive-through kiosks, and they did wonderfully, both built by hand. They serviced the population 5-star rating the entire time that we were there. So,
wow. What year was that?
Was that around 2016?
It was 2016.
Yeah. Yep.
And when did you move to Atlanta?
2017.
Yeah, at the end of the year, that's right.
Michelle left to come to Atlanta first while I stayed in North Carolina with the family. She had gotten a job at Grady as a dietitian. What also happened right around that time, right after Michelle moved here, the rest of the family, we came down and our coffee shop. So I don't know if you remember Hurricane Florence.
Oh,
it's right,
yes.
On the, yeah. So these two coffee kiosks that Michelle was describing are both probably a mile, maybe 2 miles from the beach, North Topsail Beach area, right? That North Wilmington area that you were talking about. And that area was devastated. I mean, the entire East Coast, especially in the South, but I mean, Hurricane Florence made landfall right near North Topsail Beach, which is, like I said, a mile from our shop. And so kind of really wiped us out and really solidified why we came to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. Well, lucky for us, though, I'm sure that was quite literally devastating at the time. Dope Coffee has special features, a tasting room, a community room. I love the basketball court. Please tell us about what Dope offers on site.
You know, one of the things to just talk about Atlanta quickly as we talk about Dope Coffee. So we're heavily inspired by Coca-Cola. And so if you look at Coca-Cola, you can experience it a bunch of different ways. You can go drink Coke in so many different places, but then you can also go to the museum, right? The World of Coca-Cola, it's an exhibition where you can really be immersed into the manufacturing process, the history of Coca-Cola, the traditions, and, you know, you get to experience the recipe room and mm-hmm. you get to unlock those features. But then you also have the Roxy Theater by Coca-Cola, right? Which is a performance venue. And so what Dope Coffee is doing is we're taking those cues from Coca-Cola and trying to immerse people. You know, we call it World of Coffee here, right? And so on site here, by combining those elements of a tasting room. So it's a tasting room and a training room, right? And so where we are here in South DeKalb, it's an area that's about 97% Black. So specialty coffee isn't something that's really has a immersed in steep tradition in the community yet, right? And so one of the ways that we are bringing awareness to it is by, we do classes every Wednesday, right? Where we show you how to make, you know, coffee in several different forms. There's a lounge that's kind of immersed with hip hop based art, culturally based African-American art that's all kind of telling the same story. And then like this live performance venue, which is in the roastery area, then in the basketball court, these are all in the same area. And so what they do is they create a space where the community can see itself reflected. And then once the community sees itself reflected, the product offering goes right along with it from the perspective of coffee is originated in Ethiopia, right? And so a big part of what Dope Coffee is reconnecting our community with this historical culture that kind of already belongs within the community. It has just been disconnected for several decades. And so that's a big part of what we do here is trying to create this museum-like local attraction type of environment and just connect culture and heritage and history with what's happening now.
Oh, so much thought and so many layers there. If you are just joining us, this is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Wrights, speaking with the co-owners of Dope Coffee, Michelle and Michael Lloyd. You mentioned classes and education. And Michelle, with your background as a chef and dietitian, perhaps the comparison would be what we now know about farm to table or food grown in one's own garden, how much healthier that is than commercially produced, industrially produced food. People don't know as much about the origins of coffee or chocolate. And from my understanding, it's far more expensive to offer the pure single-sourced. How do you convince people anywhere who are on a budget that what they will get is so much better for them?
So you're absolutely right. How do you convince them that what you're going to be getting as a single source or single origin bean is going to be not only better for them, but better tasting? And I'll say that we came around, hey, we just have to give people samples. We have to be in areas where people can be able to taste our coffee, because once you taste the difference, then you can't really go back from there. Even though specialty coffee is more expensive, and that is what we serve here at Dope Coffee, is specialty coffee, we make a point to not only educate with information, like in our tasting room, in our lounges, we have coffee maps with flavor regions, we have coffee making systems, we have the tools that kind of teach you about, you know, what coffee is, where it comes from, so that people can start to piece that information together. Because once you know more about what it is that you're drinking, you can differentiate it more. A lot of people think that, okay, well, you know, coffee is coffee is coffee. And once you get them to realize that there's different types of coffee, just like there's different types of chocolate, then they become more interested and more invested in not only what they're drinking, but in their health as well. Because you're right, what is grown closest to the farm has a higher value of nutrition that comes along with it. And you can't replace that when it comes to cost. And what I have found out is, like, when people are more aware of what they're buying, they're more willing to pay more for what is better for them, because they realize that it's not just about, you know, them enjoying something. They also want to enjoy their health as well. They're able to do that here.
You mentioned chocolate. This is already maybe 5-6 years ago. I was introduced to a local chocolate maker here and kind of shocked that a small bar then was $9. Maybe it's 30% more than that now. And then I watched a film, a documentary about chocolate and the sourcing, the farmers, how the people are treated. And granted, if you're on a budget, that may not be what's on your mind. And I love me my Hershey's Kisses, you know, I'll never turn down one of those. But it can be a revelation about what goes into these foods, beverages that we love, and the impact that has on us, on our health, and on society. So I guess if it means indulging a little less, but getting something so much better for you and the world at large, it's worth it.
I agree. And if I could add one thing with Dope Coffee, so understanding that we primarily, especially at the beginning, right, we were marketing to a Black community that wasn't as connected maybe in the world of specialty coffee. And this is even a few years ago, because there's already been a large cultural awakening around the product itself. One of the things that I believe we're focused on heavily at Dope Coffee is teaching people how to make great coffee at home. So what I believe happens is, you take a Starbucks, for example, for a while they had, you know, earned the nickname $4, and now that's $8, right? And so what happens is, I think that folks need to be introduced to really high quality coffee, right? Because like if you're drinking Folgers or Maxwell House, which is what my family grew up on, and then you maybe make the jump at some point to Starbucks, and then if you're asking yourself like, hey, is there a better coffee than what I'm drinking? Because talking to most people, right, regardless of race in America, they typically aren't liking the coffee that they're drinking. They're like, oh, it's too bitter, it's too dark, it makes my stomach hurt, right? And there are reasons for that, right? Typically, you know, given a choice, we as people want the better product, right? And so our emphasis is on making the best product, right? Sourcing the best coffee that we can find, which also means it's typically more expensive. But then we counter that by our focus isn't on serving coffee at retail, right? We're not like, we do have a coffee bar and we have coffee shops, and we will continue to do that for people that want the convenience. But from an educational and a programming standpoint, and as a strategy, we actually want you to make this really good coffee at home, right? Where it comes out, you know, a fraction of the cost of what it's going to be in a specialty coffee shop.
Excellent point. I was impressed to read about your collaboration with the military, veteran-run nonprofit Vets to Industry. Would you tell us more about that?
Yes. So I served 7 years active duty. We were a military family. And so a little bit of my background, I served in Afghanistan and got out in early 2017. And during that time, the war in Afghanistan was kind of winding down, but the military was not in a position where it was focused on like what's happening next for its veterans. And so that's kind of part of that transition of moving to Atlanta. Life was kind of all over the place. And I got down here and started going to some veterans networking groups. And eventually met a really good guy named Brian Arrington. He's the founder and the CEO of Vets to Industry. And so for a while, we had kind of just played phone tag with each other and saw each other at a few events. But here recently, we were both fortunate to attend the Back to Business Accelerator put on by the University of Syracuse and Fiserv. And we both won $10,000 grants at that competition. And over dinner, Brian and I, we were having dinner together and we said, man, let's go ahead and make the partnership right here, right now. We've been talking about this for 3 years. And so Vets to Industry is just a really wonderful organization that is helping to solve the types of problems that, you know, I was going through as an individual transitioning from the Marine Corps. But I think more importantly, they're saying is veterans first, or maybe it's people first, veterans and their families always. And so it's a holistic organization that's not just focused on the veteran who's transitioning, understanding that what it takes to be a military family, to be a military spouse as well, is something that needs to be supported. And so they actually have our top rated coffee. It's our Burundi, one of my favorites. It's a naturally processed Burundi. This is the top grade of coffee. So we thought, once again, you know, offer your best products to communities that need it the most. And so we make a sizable, I think it's about a 20% or so donation to, it's actually a revenue share per bag, directly goes to Vets to Industry or V2I. And we pay them out quarterly. And yeah, it's just a really good partnership. It gives me the ability to reach back into the veteran community and to be connected and involved. And it just, you know, we're here at Dope Coffee, all of our founders and currently all of our employees, anyone who's working with or around Dope Coffee is either a veteran themselves, a military spouse, or a family of veterans, right? So children of veterans. And so we have a really tight-knit group here. Both organizations kind of embody some of the same values, and so the partnership just works out really well.
Oh, it's beautiful. I have to thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Coming back full circle, does Dope have any big plans for hip-hop's 50th anniversary this year?
Yeah, so we did a show series. We actually wrap up our last show tomorrow. So I've been performing here live every other Thursday for our community and for our audience. We have a few other pretty big things. One, I'm not at liberty to say. It's a large collaboration that's happening here in Atlanta, but the final steps are being approved now. We also did a live performance and community tasting as a part of Black Man Lab. They did a 50 years of hip hop celebration at the Auburn Library, at the Historical Library in Atlanta. And so it's been really good to immerse ourselves in the 50th year of hip hop. We've been doing events ourselves and just supporting other events that have happened throughout the community.
Michael and Michelle Lloyd, co-founders and co-owners of Dope Coffee in Decatur. More information is available on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Coming up, our series Speaking of Art highlights Atlanta-based paper artist Alex Wolf. Amplifying Atlanta, this is WABE.
The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for being here. It's time now for our series, Speaking of Art, where we hear from local visual artists in their own words.
Hi, my name is Alex Wolf, and I'm an Atlanta-based paper artist. I specialize in creating organic subject matter in a linear style with hidden little Easter eggs of information about the subject matter. I am constantly playing with light and playing with the absence of space and how that creates a contour or creates a significant amount of information for the subject matter that I'm creating. It's been really fun experimental time for me. I really started art when I was little. My mom would give me crayons and paper, and I was just really content sitting for a long time. I started doing lessons around the age of 10, just painting and really enjoying creating. And then when I got to high school, I took AP ceramics because there are no more classes left in ceramics, and ended up utilizing paper stencils to transfer imagery to these infertility sculptures that I was working on. And basically I could put an image of something onto this clay and then fire it, and it would come out in a different color and it would look really great, and it worked for what I needed, but the stencils would be ruined after one use. When I was younger, I would watch shows like Crocodile Hunter and Steve Irwin and the Jeff Corwin Experience, anything on Animal Planet, really. And I realized as I got older that information didn't serve me as much and it kind of faded away. But when I got older and I had a daughter of my own and she started finding animals and life fascinating in all these new ways, I kind of just lost myself in that and realized that I found a niche in that style, that I enjoy drawing animals, I enjoy creating these little personalities in them and hiding little Easter eggs of information about them in the piece. As an artist, Atlanta is really convenient, not just because there are tons of galleries and artists and murals and opportunities to make art, but also just because you have plenty of access to references. So we have tons of museums in Atlanta. We also have access to the Botanical Gardens, so that means that you can go take pictures and draw and take in information about things from around the world that you normally wouldn't have access to. And then you can go down the street to the aquarium and see animals from around the world. So it's really given me an opportunity to practice and hone my technique and my style, because I'm never going to run out of reference imagery, reference subject matter. It's always there and it's always growing. My favorite places to look at art are kind of reminiscent of like walks I would go on when I nannied. So on the Beltline, you would look at works by like Genevieve Reed and sculptures by Judy Koth and more paintings by like Barry Lee and Chris Feel, Dr. Dax. There's like Little Doors by Tiny Doors ATL along the way as well. And if you follow that Eastern Trail, you're going to end up over by Krog Tunnel and Krog Street. And over there, you're going to find ABB Gallery. And they are owned by Greg Mike, who is an amazing contemporary artist. He has local murals pretty much all over the city of Atlanta. And they show artists like Kilimari, Sammy Jack, George F. Baker, Ash Wolf Dog Hainer, Chris Noosh, and tons more. And those are my definite favorite places. If you'd like to see my work, you can see my entire portfolio and all my works in progress on my Instagram, which is at ATLEXWOLF. And you can find any available works for purchase on artsy.net. That's ARTSY.net by searching my name, Alex Wolf. And then I also participate regularly in the Drink and Doodles and live events at ABV Gallery. So be sure to follow my Instagram and their Instagram at ABV Gallery to stay up to date on those events and happenings. And if you're ever outside of the city of Atlanta visiting Macon, you can see some of my rotating works at Macon Arts Alliance in downtown. Thanks for having me.
Atlanta-based paper artist Alex Wolf and our series Speaking of Art. More information about Wolf's work, as well as our entire Speaking of series, is on our website, wabe.org/speakingof. In a moment, wildlife enthusiast Christian Cave slithers up to the mic to discuss the many varieties of snakes that live in and around our city. Amplifying Atlanta, this is 90.1 WABE. This is City Life on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for being here. Last year, City Lights introduced you to Christian Cave, the Kennesaw State University Environmental Studies major, who is on a mission to help us love and care about Georgia wildlife rather than fear it. Cave is now a City Lights contributor for our series, Expedition Atlanta. Every other month, the passionate wildlife enthusiast shares seasonal information and insights into the wonderful world of wildlife that surrounds us. When City Lights senior producer Kim Drobes recently caught up with Cave, he explained what we should look for as the summer season approaches.
Well, there's a lot. I'm sure all of you know mosquitoes and other bugs are going to be in full effect soon. So I don't know if that's necessarily great news, but some of my favorite animals that are going to be out also in full effect are going to be the reptiles. Lately, I've started to see it now. Snakes have been out, and we call it like the spring emergence or whatnot. But now that we're coming into, you know, the summertime, they're going to be out a little bit more. And with the good warm weather and stuff like that, you can expect more just reptile activity.
And where are they going during the winter if they're just coming out now?
So they typically just go underground or under logs. Snakes in particular, they'll usually find like a good pile of rocks or logs or some burrow into the ground, and they go into what's called brumation, which is like, think of the cold-blooded version of hibernation. It's not exactly the same, but it's basically cold-blooded animals' version of hibernation.
That makes sense. So if I really want to see some reptiles, where's the best place to go near Atlanta?
If you're looking for reptiles, I'd say your easiest bet at finding them are going to be in some of the more wooded area. So if you know any of like hiking trails or areas like that, I mentioned Sweetwater Creek State Park a lot. It's because you can see a lot of diverse wildlife there, but also any of the Chattahoochee like nature trails, like those types of areas that are around here. And basically you want to go before it gets too hot, because you know, they're ectotherms. They need outside temperatures to determine their internal temperatures and whatnot. And so if it gets too hot, they're not going to be out on the surface. But if you go a little bit earlier in the morning, as the heat starts to pick up and you start just walking trails, I guarantee you it won't take you too long once the sun gets out and starts warming up for you to start seeing snakes, lizards, other things like that out on the crawl.
I love that we're talking about snakes. I was recently on a Facebook group page for my neighborhood, and a resident posted a picture of a pretty impressive looking snake that they encountered while walking through our nearby Brownwood Park. The snake has since been identified as a water snake, and I was hoping you would share some background on this species. How common is it to see a snake like this in an Atlanta city park?
Oh, goodness. Neurodia. The water snake. That's the genus Neurodia. We have a couple of species in the state. They're all very they're very interesting snakes, and they often get mischaracterized for cottonmouths, otherwise known as water moccasins, just because of both types of snakes' proclivity to be around water. But water snakes are completely harmless. Every single snake in the Neurodia genus is absolutely non-venomous. But if you corner them or go to catch them, typically their first mode of action is to jump in the water. People hardly ever see them. I've seen tons of people in state parks sitting on rocks by creeks and streams with a huge water snake just sitting there sunning itself right next to them. And they never see them because the snakes often just sit still and hide. And then the minute they do see them or they move too quick, the snakes jump right in the water. Hence the name water snake. They're exceptional swimmers. And they're pretty much around all types of bodies of water that you can find, from like ponds, creeks, streams, rivers, man-made ponds, ditches, things like that. Anywhere where there's like fish and frogs, basically prey items available, you can find water snakes in the metro Atlanta area. The species that you're more likely, I guess you could say, to encounter are going to be the northern water snake, Neurodia cipadon. And in our area, we actually have the midland water snake, Neurodia cipadon pluralis. They look almost identical, but you have to like count the stripes on them or something like that. Long story short, they're both harmless snakes and pretty close in relation to each other. But yeah, you can find them around pretty common. I mean, I'm serious. Any sunny day, go to an area where there's some water flowing that's pretty clean and you'll see a water snake.
Well, this is interesting because Brownwood Park near us doesn't really have a large body of water. It does have city runoff and there is a creek, but from the picture I saw, it looked like the snake was not right next to where the water source is. So if we were to encounter a snake like this, are we doing it a favor if we try to get it closer to the water, or should we just leave it be?
I'd say that unless you encountered it in like a road or somewhere, of course, where it's going to likely be injured or killed, it would probably be best just to leave them alone, only because even though water snakes are non-venomous and harmless, I say harmless loosely because they can bite, and some of my most painful bites have been from water snakes. They still have teeth that are sharp and ready to hold on to slippery prey like frogs and fish. You know, you would want to be careful of handling those guys just because they're not very docile snakes. They can be quite defensive. For some reason, they're just very feisty and when cornered or grabbed, of course. But like I said, for the most part, if you approach one, it'll likely slither away or run off before you even, you know, get the chance to even see it. But if you could use a stick, I'd say that's your best bet. But yeah, handling them is probably not too easy. They're just very defensive snakes.
So at the front end, you mentioned that they resemble, is it cottonmouths?
Yes. Echistrodon piscivorus is the snake that everybody fears around water in the South, especially the water moccasin. And some people call it the name cottonmouth, because when they're cornered, they open up their mouths, and the mouth on the inside, the flesh is bright white. And it's kind of an aposematic, meaning like bright color, flashy warning sign to predators to leave the snake alone. And there are areas in Georgia, down more in the coastal plains, where water snakes and cottonmouths can be found in the same creek. I've been in a creek before where I've stepped over like 10 cottonmouths and found two water snakes or something like that. So we are often pretty wary in the South about, you know, or really around the United States, just being around snakes around water, because, you know, you never know if one of them's a venomous water moccasin or if the other one's just a water snake. But there's a couple of ways you can distinguish them. And luckily, up in the metro Atlanta area, cottonmouths are far less common. I have heard people give me pretty accurate accounts of finding them, so I won't say they're absent, but they're far less common up north in Georgia than they are down south in Georgia.
And heaven forbid I was to get bit by one, what do I do?
Seek medical attention. Luckily, their venom, while being potent, is not nearly as potent as other snakes in the United States, like rattlesnakes, for example. But you still should get medical attention. And we have anti-venoms readily available for species like the copperheads and cottonmouths available in the United States. So you should be able to get, you know, medical attention and be right on your way, you know, hopefully, you know, venom affects everybody differently. So it can, for somebody else, it might not be the worst thing ever, but for you, it could be. So I'd never say just, you know, walk it off. Just seek medical attention and try to stay calm. You know, you don't want to freak out too much, as that's going to, you know, just make your situation more complicated. Just, you know, try to get some pressure on the area of biting, and then just, yeah, get some medical attention.
Well, that is good advice. Very solid. So last time we spoke, you were about to depart for quite an adventure, an expedition to Ecuador. How was the trip?
Oh my goodness. I'm still on fire. I mean, absolutely incredible is how it went. It was hands down the coolest thing I've ever done in my life. So I got to be literally in the place that I dreamed of since I was a kid and read about it in books. I'm in the Amazon rainforest back in March, and I'm tagging alongside some very incredible biologists, Alejandra Arteaga and Amanda Casada, and they do phenomenal work of conserving herpetofauna, which are like the reptiles and amphibians that I love, in the Amazon rainforest. And so they invited me over there because of my social media page, and figured we could do kind of a collaboration where I'd bring some attention to the Kamai Foundation, which is the foundation Alejandro started to combat gold mining that's going on in this area of the Amazon rainforest. And so there's this area called the Pitalala Preserve, which is like this newly established preserve in the Amazon rainforest that could serve as a corridor between Hatun Sacha, which has been a preserve in the Amazon rainforest that has been long established and is incredibly biodiverse. And if we can connect the Pitalala Preserve to Hatun Sacha, it could save and conserve so much wildlife and just biodiversity. It's absolutely astounding. But like I said, there's gold mining going on in the area. And so I got to essentially see for 4 days in a row the most incredible biodiversity. I mean, every leaf you looked at or looked under had a myriad of incredible insects and crazy spiders. Every single hole in a tree had a tarantula the size of my head sticking out of it. I mean, I was in paradise. Like where we were staying in these cabins smack dab deep in the jungle. And I go in the shower at night and there's bullet ants and whip scorpions all over the walls and bats in the ceiling and just crazy stuff like that, you know? The snakes were, I mean, beautiful. I got to catch a rainbow boa, which is a snake that I'd always dreamed of seeing. I caught one just hiking off in the jungle in the morning, and I was screaming so loud. I was far away from camp, but I was screaming so loud about it that the biologist Alejandro come running through the woods like, oh, what did you get? What did you get? And I'm like, oh my goodness, like I got a rainbow boa. And they were laughing because they were like, yeah, we were making sure you were still okay. Like we just heard screaming from over the tree line and we were like, okay. But yeah, I was on fire. I got to catch a caiman, which was really exciting. It's basically think of like a miniature alligator or kind of crocodile, but like a South American one of those. Yeah, I got to catch one of those. That was pretty exciting. And so, yeah, I got my fill on all types of wildlife. It was absolutely insane.
That is so wonderful. You know, we set you up here on City Lights as a wildlife enthusiast, but if we're being completely honest with people, you are an enthusiast of the creepiest and crawliest creatures out there, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can tell the biologists were very, I don't know if I should say impressed or concerned by my affinity for picking up all these massive tarantulas. And there was a bullet ants, which are, you know, supposedly the most painful sting in the insect world, hence the name bullet ant. Apparently, it feels like you get shot if you get stung by them. And they call them a conga. That was like the native word for them over there. And I held my first one my first day in there. My hand was shaking so much. And then I kind of saw that, oh, okay, these are like the velvet ants that you can find back at home, kind of, which are actually wasps. But long story short, if you've ever seen those bright red ants, they kind of look furry. They almost look like little like fuzz balls with bright red fur that walk around in the summer. They sting pretty painful too. Some people call them cow killers. But nonetheless, I kind of noticed that the behavior was somewhat the same, that, you know, you just kind of let the insect decide where it wants to go when you're handling it and don't try to smush it and it won't sting you. And so I got my fill of working with the bullet ants. And then finally I got so comfortable with them that we were eating dinner one night and one of the biologists, he goes, oh, turn around. There's a conga on your backpack. And so there's this bullet ant walking around investigating my backpack. And I walk over and I just pick it up and I heard everybody gasp in the room. Like they were like, you know, I just go pick it up and walked it outside and just brushed it off and it goes crawling on its way. And they were like, oh my goodness, you're nuts. And I'm like, oh, you know, it's just an ant, you know, it's just, you know. So yeah, I'm definitely passionate about all the creepy crawlies for sure.
Oh my gosh. You may actually be a little bit nuts though, right? You may be a little bit nuts.
Maybe a little, maybe a little.
Wildlife enthusiast Christian Cave, speaking with City Lights senior producer Kim Drobes. More information about Cave, as well as our series Expedition Atlanta, is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Speaking of the great outdoors, research increasingly shows that some form of physical activity each day can lead to better health and a longer life. 74-year-old Atlantan Carolyn Hartfield knows from personal experience and serves as a role model. She's a health and wellness coach who is passionate about sharing her love of the outdoors with other senior citizens. City Lights producer Summer Evans spoke with Carolyn Hartfield about her road to wellness.
I grew up in the city. I was a girly girl, and I had absolutely no interest in the outdoors. However, for my 56th birthday, I am one of those late bloomer baby boomers. I was invited out on a hike. And usually for my birthday, I try and do something I've never done before. So I accepted the challenge. And my first hike ever in life was at Blood Mountain in the North Georgia Mountains.
Oh, awesome.
Yes, and it was one of the most exhilarating experiences I had had in my life. I was hooked the first time.
Man, and that's not an easy hike for that to be your very first one.
And I didn't know it was supposed to be hard. I was enjoying it so much. And at the end of the hike, that's when the hike leader said, Carolyn, if you can do this one, you can do any of the trails we hike. This is one of our hardest ones.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When did you realize this newfound active lifestyle was improving both your mental as well as your physical health?
Well, actually, that goes back a little bit to the last day of my 49th year when I went to the doctor and I was diagnosed as pre-hypertensive. I'm the previous owner of health food stores, so I thought I was really doing pretty good, you know, health-wise. And I just absolutely refused to accept that. And I started walking right after that and haven't stopped.
Oh, wow. It just shows it's not even just what you eat, but how you are physically getting up and walking and running and everything.
Absolutely. And being active. And my whole key is in my activities is to have fun. So I don't grudgingly look forward to it. I excitedly look forward to being in the outdoors and just enjoying nature and also meeting other people as well. And I have to tell you, I felt like there must be other people out there like me. And that's when I started my group.
Mm. Did you take any formal education classes in order to become a health and wellness coach?
I did. I attended Emory University for their health coach training and also the international, I forgot the other one, for the wellness coach. But I did get certificates from both of them, yes. And I owned several health food stores for about 5-6 years back in the 80s.
Nice. So you already had that basis of healthy foods and that sort of thing?
Yes.
What have been some of your favorite adventures you've had since becoming more active and hiking and walking?
Well, that's a very, very good question because I have gone zip lining. I have gone, and I'm not a strong swimmer, but I can swim. I have gone kayaking. I actually, for one of my birthdays, went to visit a friend in Colorado and hiked the Rockies. That was the tallest. And when I say hike, we actually backpacked. And what made that so special was we had a full moon. We didn't even need our headlamps because we ended up going up the side of the mountain at night, actually.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was really, really, that was phenomenal for me.
That sounds exhilarating. Are people ever like surprised when they see you on a trail and you're just like keeping up with the rest of them? You know, do you ever get any looks or just like, wow, you are in such great shape?
Yes and no, I guess I'll say. I don't really pay much attention to that, but usually with my groups, I'm usually the oldest one. So I encourage those younger than me, look, if I can do this, I know you can also.
Absolutely. In 2022, you were named as a Senior Planet Sponsored Athlete with AARP. What did that new title entail?
Oh my gosh. First of all, I have to tell you that even though I do these activities that are fun, I never considered myself to be an athlete. So this was just such an honor to even be looked at as an athlete. I consider myself an unintentional athlete because of the things I do just for having fun. several years prior to that, AARP had honored me with to represent them with an award, Profiles in Positive Aging. And I want to tell you, I'm just living my life, having a wonderful time. So to be a sponsored athlete, I stood up a little taller and decided to have more fun.
What have been some stories you've received from seniors who have participated in your walks?
Yes, one in particular, well, two that come to mind that I'll quickly share. One is one of the walkers, she said that she could barely walk across her living room without being winded. So she said she was never an outdoors person, you know, sit and watch TV. And her doctor told her, you need to walk at least half hour each day or 5 days a week. And she said, how can I do that? You know, I can't walk across my living room. What is he talking about? So as we are sometimes, she said, I'll show him. I'll get it done. And 6 weeks after doing that, she found she had lost 10 pounds. She was walking with us in my Just Walk program. And we had been walking 45 minutes. And because we had conversation and socialization going on, she didn't realize that she had walked that long and how far. So that's one of the benefits of being with others that helps you to move on. And one of the things that I definitely like to express, and that is, as we're aging, to embrace the joys of aging and let that little light shine upon others so that they too may savor in the spices of life. Life just gets better. It's all in how you look at it.
Health and wellness coach Carolyn Hartfield. More information is available on our website, wabe.org. You've been listening to City Lights, our daily exploration of arts and culture. Catch an encore broadcast tonight at 9. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., Jamal Barber details his experience as a contestant on MTV's high-stakes art competition reality show, The Exhibit. Plus, artist and creative director D.L. Warfield discusses his work on iconic Outkast album covers. If you missed part of today's show, like my earlier conversation with the co-owners of Dope Coffee, Michael and Michelle Lloyd, you could catch up through our podcast or on our website, wabe.org/citylights. There you'll find a complete archive of our stories, so you can listen to City Lights on your schedule. City Lights senior producer is Kim Droves. Our producers are Summer Evans and Janine Etter, and our engineer is Shelley Canavy. I'm your host, Lois Reitzes. Thanks for listening to WABE Atlanta.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.